Duval County Schools looks to sue the state of Florida. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. Or stream us live on Facebook right now. Just ahead, the Duval County School Board votes to join the lawsuit against the state over its controversial Schools of Hope legislation. What do you think? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, it's a movable feast today on the show as Lee Court visits Hot Shot Bakery and Cafe and Dad'll Be Good Hot Sauce in St. Augustine. Plus, we've got a look at the current financial crisis with the U.S. Secret Service as we speak with a former agent. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, our local school board is taking on the state legislature in a battle over charter schools. Duval school board members voted 4-2 Monday to join 10 other districts suing the state over the major education law passed by the Florida legislature last spring. The law, known as House Bill 7069, contains a number of measures that lawyers for school districts around Florida say are unconstitutional and will hurt school districts overall but benefit charter schools. Now, the biggest legal target is the new law's so-called Schools of Hope measure. What it does is set aside more than $100 million to create charter schools in areas near D or F-rated public schools. Some of those schools will be forced to close. Opponents of the law say the Schools of Hope measure removes most of what little oversight they had over charter schools in their areas. Now, charter schools are privately run public schools. Duval County has 31 of them. With more about the lawsuit and what it might mean for education in the state, we welcome WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride. She's been covering this and joins us now in studio. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
And here's our question to callers. What do you think of the Duval County School Board's move to sue the state over this Schools of Hope measure? Other school districts have done the same. The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax, or you can weigh in on Facebook. And so, 4-2, the Duval County School Board said, we are all in taking on the state legislature. Can you explain how this lawsuit is going to work?
Yeah, well, let me first back up a little bit and just talk about the legislation. So it's the bill, a lot of people call it the Schools of Hope bill because that was kind of the most notorious piece of it, although that's not necessarily like the main piece they're challenging. They're basically saying that there are elements in this bill that could be unconstitutional. That's one of five parts that they're challenging. And a lot of it is based on the fact that the Florida Constitution gives the school board the right to operate, control, and supervise all free public schools within the school district. That's one element that in the Constitution that they're saying isn't being followed with this law, possibly. So what the school district's legal team, well, it's the city's legal team, they're combined, they drew up a memorandum basically saying these are different things that could be challenged. These are things that we're finding in other school districts in the city or in the state are saying, you know, these are the problematic areas. We don't know what the lawsuit's going to look like yet. It hasn't been drafted. There's 10 other schools that have voted that they're going to put in money as well. Our school district voted that $25,000 is the max right now. It's supposed to be non-public money, so not state or not federal dollars that they'll be using. They have some money that comes in. It's, you know, private money. That they would be using for it. And so, yeah, we don't really know what the lawsuit itself will look like or the timeline necessarily. They're just saying, you know, all these other districts are going in. We are too.
Okay. And voting to join the lawsuit, Board Chair Paula Wright, Board Members Lori Hershey, Becky Couch, and Warren Jones, Ashley Smith-Juarez and Scott Shine voted against the measure. Cheryl Grimes was absent. Here's Board Chair Wright explaining why she is in favor of the lawsuit.
It is strictly about the constitutionality of the provisions set forth in House Bill 7069. I have a good relationship with the legislators. I've made a point to meet with them all by going to Tallahassee 6 or 7 times. And as a board, we had several board members. We even sent a bus down to Tallahassee that included students and parents and advocates. So it's only about, is this constitutional?
Okay. Voting against Ashley Smith-Juarez and Scott Shine. Here's Shine explaining his reasoning.
I don't know that litigation is going to work. I mean, that is, by definition, adversarial review. And I think where we need to push is a more favorable collaborative relationship with our legislators. And one thing that concerns me is in my district, all of the legislators that are in that district voted to support 7069. So I don't want to be in conflict with them. I want to go back into the next session and try to find a way to work out some of the problems.
However, most large school districts around the state aren't taking that tack of collegiality and collaboration, Lindsay. They're going right at the legislature in this extraordinary way. 10 districts banding together and suing. They're saying that this measure would drain funds out of public schools, which need capital improvements, put them into charter schools. And there were other issues they have with the legislation.
Yeah, so I just want to differentiate, too, between things they don't like about the bill and things that might actually be unconstitutional, right? So there are definitely elements in the bill that they don't think are favorable to public schools. Schools of Hope is a good example. Yes, there are elements of Schools of Hope that they think might be unconstitutional in this, but really that's the most controversial piece because, you know, that got the most media play. It was saying, you know, these schools could be shut down, they could be turned into charters, charters could go open up in those areas, it's favorable. But this is, let me give an example of something that's a little bit more clear cut and less sexy than the Schools of Hope portion, I guess. So for instance, one thing the bill does is it requires school districts use a standard charter school contract. So right now, well, I guess not right now, but before the bill passed, they were able to negotiate contracts to really fit each different charter school company. So for instance, I think it was Charter School USA or one of the bigger companies that have people from out of state running, owning the charter schools. They said, you need to have someone in Jacksonville on the ground to deal with parents, to be able to, you know, talk to people who are going to your schools. That was an element they put in the contract specific to that charter school company. With this passing, they wouldn't be able to do that. So they're saying this takes away our right to operate, control, and supervise schools, which is in the Florida Constitution.
Takes away local control.
Right.
Yeah.
Another example is what you were just saying, the capital improvement tax. So that's a local tax revenue that they would be forced to share with charter schools. And there's in this memorandum, they show that, you know, there's a section of the Constitution that says it prohibits local governments from giving, lending, or using taxing power to aid any corporation. They're saying this could be problematic. So there's definitely elements in the bill people just don't like and they don't think are good for schools. But then there are other elements that they're saying, well, this could actually be unconstitutional. The goal, obviously, though, is to throw the bill out, you know?
Yeah, sure. Now, is there any precedent for this around the country where other school districts have banded together and taken on their state legislature over this type of measure that really rewards or in the views of the legislators, levels the playing field for charters, in the views of the school board members, is weakening public education overall?
You know, I'm really not sure about other states. I know Florida is kind of at the forefront of, you know, with charter schools. Like, we as a state are kind of one of the ones ahead of the game. Like, for instance, you know, everyone was upset that, but when Betsy DeVos became education secretary, she was very and interested in the voucher system, saying, and, you know, Florida, we already have a system similar to that. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, we've been doing this for a while, and we're getting to the point where other states, people who think that this is destroying public education, right? Like, that's the argument, that this type of move, giving, you know, you're giving.
Yeah, and that's, let me just jump in. That's really the underbelly of all this, whether or not you believe that these types of pieces of legislation are good faith attempts to provide choice and competition for parents seeking quality education, or whether you believe that this is a backdoor way that has been going on, opponents say, for many years, to dismantle traditional K through 12 public education.
I mean, you're absolutely right. That is the argument. I mean, people who are in favor of this bill also point out the really positives this bill brings. Like, there are lots of teacher bonuses in it. It takes some of the weight off of VAM, which, you know, school, you know, people like. You know, there are elements in this bill. It even deals with things like letting kids bring sunscreen to school. Like, this bill is massive. The way this bill was put together is the Friday before they had to vote on it, the Senate and the House leadership, they got together and then they meshed together all these bills to make one massive, nearly 300-page bill.
And that was the criticism. It was sort of done in secret at the last minute.
And people who were in favor of the bill argue it's not in secret because most of the bills went through committee process. There were a couple exceptions of things that were tacked on that may have failed. But I don't know why you would tack a bill together like this, other than you just wanted everything to pass. You know, I don't know.
Okay. And lots of calls on this. What do you think about Duval County joining 10 other districts around Florida and suing the state over its Schools of Hope charter school measure? 549-2937. Jay in Tampa. Hey, Jay, go ahead.
Good morning. And I'm a product of Duval County Public Schools myself, and I still, you know, spend a lot of time in Jacksonville, but I'm a board member for a charter school, and we are not a private corporation. While there are the charter schools have boards similar to nonprofits that are accountable to the students and the families that are being served. So I think, one, we need to be careful in how we're describing exactly how charter schools operate, so it doesn't sound like a private company, you know, operating completely outside the bounds of what we would expect. Two, I think this whole thing is pitting charter schools against traditional neighborhood schools. And the problem that we have at a deeper level is that Florida underfunds its education system. And in some neighborhoods, there aren't alternatives, save a charter school. So if there were no charter schools, it wouldn't be a sudden windfall of money going into communities that have been underserved for decades in some cases.
Yeah.
So I think we need to fight the right fight here. We certainly don't want to give away public dollars to private interests, but we also don't want to fight ourselves in the effort to provide quality education for students.
Thanks, Jay.
He has some really good points. I think that, you know, one thing he brought up is that, you know, they're not, you know, a lot of these charter schools, too, are nonprofits. And yesterday, our school board even said, you know, we really like a lot of our charter schools. You know, we have a problem with some of, you know, I always see that they have a bigger problem with some of these big companies that come in. They don't set up in
those are for-profit companies, too.
And they'll set up in areas.
But as you said, not all charters are for-profit.
Right. Yeah. And they'll set up in areas sometimes that aren't the most in need. So then it seems like, okay, are you just trying to profit off of education? You know, that's where that argument normally comes in. But I think, you know, he does have a good point that sometimes there is need for innovation in areas, and that's the argument for them to begin with. And as far as having the board, that is a good point. I think our school board pointed out yesterday their issue with local or charter school boards deciding where tax revenue is spent is that, you know, they are elected. The school board is elected by the people. A lot of times the charter school boards are self-appointed or, you know, they elect each other type of deal. So, you know, is that fair? Is that how the public wants their money spent? I don't know, but that was some of their arguments when they voted on this yesterday.
Tim is in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. I just want to say, first of all, that I strongly commend our four school board members for having the courage of leadership to move forward with this. I also want to point out, I've done a little bit of math, and now that Duval is in, 11 districts, this represents 52.5% of Florida public school children. The majority of Florida public school children are now being represented by this challenge. And as we know, there's strength in numbers because these are some of the largest districts in the state. Now, if we could only get Tampa Bay, Hillsborough, Pasco, and Pinellas to jump on board, we'd be at two-thirds. Nevertheless, I also want to offer perspective, just my background. I'm a music education professor at the University of North Florida. I've been a public school educator all my life. I've also worked in some private schools, and I've even stepped into a couple charter schools as a substitute to help out. So my perspective is fairly well informed. I want to encourage everybody who has not yet formed an informed opinion about charter schools to find out for yourself. In my experience, my personal observations and the stories of others is that there are a small number of outstanding charter schools. Unfortunately, the overwhelming majority, we're talking about over 80%, do not perform any better than the public school in their neighborhood. In fact, they are often less effective than the neighborhood public school.
Tim, thanks for that. And that's, of course, the argument that foes are making. Yeah. What about his last part of his comment?
Yeah. Okay. So I haven't necessarily done the math of what fraction do better or worse. But I will tell you that in this legislation, obviously one of the big portions is the Schools of Hope portion, right? And so what that does is it basically gives neighborhood schools less time to improve their grades. So if they have a D or F, they used to have more time to improve their grades before the state intervenes. And so it gives them less options to turn the school around. So there used to be like six options. Now it gives them like four. Then, essentially they'll close the school down if they don't improve in time. And then a charter school could be incentivized to come into that area, not necessarily the building, but 5 miles within that school's area. Now, the argument from the people who are proponents of this bill is that the charters have to be a high-performing charter. The argument against it is that some of these charters known as high-performing, they might be high-performing in some areas and not others. And are they going to perform high in an area that's in need, and the argument is that charters and neighborhood schools, they have the same issues. They have the same issues in areas
dealing
of poverty.
With
they have the
same socioeconomic conditions.
Yeah, so,
poverty, family breakdown, etc.
Exactly. So, as you can see, this is a contentious issue. There
sure.
are many, many thoughts.
Okay. Ben on the South Side. Hey, Ben. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I was going to let everybody know it's easy to have an opinion about whether or not we should have public schools or privately run charter schools. We'll let you have some skin in the game. I got three children all that are in charter schools. Before that, we were in public school, and we found that the services of the public school were greatly lacking. I am a product of Duval County Public School. I went to public school my whole life here, and I slowly watched the decline of our public schools. The funding, the quality of classroom time the teachers have with the kids. It's more about testing now and politics. I find it a little troubling that we have one portion of our government suing the other portion of our government. It seems like a waste of time. It seems like they're trying to hold on to their positions of power and as far as a school board member goes. It seems like really what we ought to do is push towards more oversight. Maybe legislation that gives a separate entity the power to make sure that the charter schools are keeping up the same standards. Really, it's kind of disappointing that we're trying to prop up these aging structures. Even the buildings themselves have gone into decline. If you go to any one of our schools that are over 20 years old, there is empty classrooms. There is broken bathrooms. There is signs of, decline.
No, you're absolutely right, Ben. And isn't it? Thank you for that, Ben. He's right about that. But that said, isn't this lawsuit in part challenging the fact that this legislation would siphon money away from improving the physical plants? The public schools are saying, you're giving us less money to fix the broken bathrooms and roofs and things like that.
So I think it's about $15 million over the next 3 years. Basically, they have to share their capital tax funding, that's the local tax, with charter schools. And they basically already have huge amount of maintenance projects that are unfunded. I mean, their schools are an average of, 60 years or older. Some are like 100 years old, or 90. So he's right. They definitely have majorly aging schools in Duval County that they can't get to the projects. I mean, I think the air conditioning budget is, you know, four times what they have budgeted for this year, you know, as far as things that need to be fixed. You know, it's just, it's fixing windows, it's leaking roofs, it's cracked flooring, it's all these things that they can't get to. And he's right about that. This is about the school district wanting the control, because they feel as though the state, they feel like this isn't fiscally conservative, this bill. They also feel like, you know, this is taking away local power. It's big government, you know, it's the state taking control over what the local school board's job is. So they do want their power. That is part of this. And they think that, they say the people elected them, that this is what they want.
And what about his point of view as a guy who took his kids and put them in charters because he perceives that the quality has declined.
And it sounds like he's had a better experience in that charter school. Actually, I'm sad that he's off the line too, because I wanted to ask him which one. And because, I was curious. But yeah, I mean, that is the argument. That is the argument of a lot of parents who do put their kids in charter schools, that it feels like even a private school sometimes, it feels like something special, like they might have more money or this or that.
Okay. So now that Duval's in, where does the lawsuit go from here?
So right now they have to actually draft the lawsuit. So right now they're basically just saying, we're agreeing to be a part of this lawsuit. I don't have a timeline on it. The legal team is supposed to give the school board monthly updates from here on out, now that they've voted in favor of it. So they'll have to draft the lawsuit. It's possible more school districts could join in. I think some others might be considering it still, but these are just the 10 who have officially voted on it, and now we're the 11th. So, yeah, from here, I think we're just going to wait and see.
Will it be heard at the state? Will it make its way up to the state Supreme Court? Where will it be heard?
We will see. Yeah.
Okay. She's WJCT's own Lindsay Kilbride. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Flooding is a fact of life across America, not just in coastal communities like those in Texas dealing with Harvey. The nation needs to plan for sea level rise and record-breaking rain. The latest from Houston and what's being done where you live to prepare for the next big flood. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
President Donald Trump has always claimed to be a billionaire.
When I say about the $10 billion, I'm not doing that to brag.
But he makes a lot of claims.
So you asked me to figure out how much money Donald Trump was worth?
What we found out on the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor, Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. She is the hottest chef in the nation's oldest city, literally. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and culinary trends around town, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks with Sherry Stoppelbein, owner and executive chef of Hot Shot Bakery and Cafe and the That'll Be Good Hot Sauce in St. Augustine.
Have a banana. Hannah, try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davey,
come to my house. Try a tomato, please.
Good morning, Sherry Stoppelbean from St. Augustine and Hotshot Bakery and Cafe and That'll Be Good products. I mean, that was a mouthful, but I have to tell you, I'm so happy to have you on Movable Feast and to be able to talk about so many of the food organizations and companies that you have in St. Augustine for more than 30 years. So welcome, and share a little bit about your history in St. Augustine and being from Menorcan descent.
Well, I'm actually from St. Augustine. I was born there, and my mother is of Menorcan descent. And that didn't really have any effect on us growing up. And as I grew up and got into food and went to culinary school, it became a huge part of my life. And I have used the dattle in many different aspects of my business forever. I've got sauces, I bake with it, I cook with it, I dip it in chocolate. We have an annual competition using that. And it's in my daily menus at the cafe. It's something that's well known in St. Augustine now, not so much out of St. Augustine. It is growing, but it is very big in St. Augustine now.
Well, let's start with the little green and yellow dattle pepper, because we need to describe it so that our listeners can understand what it is, and then we'll segue right into Hotshot Bakery.
Well, originally it was a small pepper, maybe an inch and a half. But through the years, because so many people have gotten into the dattle growing, it has grown. Now, I just picked a bunch yesterday, and it was easy, a three-inch long pepper. And that's just because we save our seeds year to year and the best of the crop year to year, and the pepper is just growing more so. Who knows where it's headed? I personally don't want to see it get much bigger, but it might. Who knows?
Well, I was always amazed that the dattle pepper was indigenous to St. Augustine.
Yes.
So when I moved there 2 decades ago and I met the little dattle pepper, I was really impressed with its differentiating it from other peppers. There's a very interesting little sweet aroma and a taste that, of course, it's hot, but there's a sweetness that exudes from it, too.
Yes, it's not a macho pepper at all. Most of them have no flavor. This one really does. It's a cousin to the habanero. There's a sweet dattle, and it looks like a baby habanero. It's just amazing. It has no heat to it, but it tastes just like the dattle. And the dattle came to St. Augustine with the Menorcans. And we were raised thinking that it was brought from Menorca when they came, but it wasn't. Originally, as far back as I know that anyone's found, it came from Peru. And they picked it up in Cuba and brought it with them. They must have stopped there for their supplies on the way up and brought it with them. And we've just kept it going all these many, many years.
But that doesn't mean that everything that you are now doing in your lovely, charming Cordova Street Hotshot Bakery and Cafe is hot, because you have sweets and confections and paninis and smoothies. And tell us about your menu and Hotshot Cafe.
Well, I have forever been farm to table, even before it was award. In fact, when many years ago, if I served squash, I grew it. It was just as fresh as it possibly could be. And I still work that way, but we are able to purchase from our local farmers now what I'm using. Even the dattles, I've had to move on to growers because I just can't raise enough myself. But our menu is all fresh. The breads are all handmade. The sauces and spreads and whatever we make, serve on the sandwiches, is all handmade. We have many different choices there, just like our cranberry mustard. That's an item that takes 7 days to make, so it's always planned ahead.
And you have the cutest location. You are not just in a strip shopping center. You're on Cordova Street in historic St. Augustine in a cute historic building where you have a little outdoor cafe in the front and an outdoor deck in the back. And it's just, it's a landmark unto itself.
It is. It's in the historical district, so it's a sister house to the house next door to us that is Scarlett O'Hara's. There was two sisters that owned the homes, and I believe they were built in the 1700s. And at one time, they looked alike. They no longer because of additions and changes, but it's a fabulous location. We were right in the walking traffic in the parking area, and our locals can still get to us and come straight down Carrera, don't have to deal with the craziness on King Street. And it's just turned into a wonderful location.
So where do you see Hot Shot Bakery and Cafe proceeding this year? Oh, I need to go back and mention something because I continually think about the 450th anniversary that we just celebrated, I think it was 2 years ago in St. Augustine. And you were chosen to feed Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel. And I remember him at the Bridge of Lions and eating delicious foods from Hot Shot Bakery and Cafe and just raving. And I know that you do a lot of catering and special events too.
Yes, we do. That day I was asked to feed them and, I mean, to prepare dishes on television and then to feed them. So I had five different selections on television, and then in the background we had breakfast set up for them, and I had made a, using some of our house-made chorizo sausage, and made a casserole with eggs and peppers and onions and potatoes and what have you. And that's what you're referring to that he loved so much. And he loved it so much, he asked for my card so that when he came back to St. Augustine to visit, because he was bringing his family, he was so impressed with St. Augustine that he wanted to look us up so he could eat with us again.
Well, there's never a day with you, Sherry Stoppelbein, that you're not creating something new, new to eat, new to inspire others. And I look forward to going back to Hot Shot Cafe and having a smoothie because it's hot summer. And just give me a fork and pass over the cheesecake.
Yes, ma'am, I will.
Thank you for joining me today on Movable Feast. And I'll see you on Cordova Street.
Thank you.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.
We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our 30th anniversary retrospective, featuring interviews from our first 2 years. We'll hear a 1987 interview with Ronnie Spector of the girl group The Ronettes, and 1988 interviews with Otis Williams of The Temptations, and Ben E. King, who was a lead singer of The Drifters and had the hit Stand By Me. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Kenny Ogunis hikes the entire Great Plains.
I think I've trespassed across America probably more than anyone alive.
A newsman from Tampa shares some wild stories from Florida.
My favorite one is the headline, Man in Road Rage Incident Runs Over Self.
And look at the state's nobler achievements.
Did you know that we put men on the moon? And we did it from Central Florida.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Well, Welcome back. Well, the Secret Service is dealing with a crisis right now. It can no longer pay hundreds of agents it needs to carry out its protective mission. Now, this is in large part due to the sheer size of President Trump's family and the manpower needed to secure their multiple homes up and down the East Coast. The Secret Service director recently told USA Today that more than 1,000 agents have already hit their federally mandated caps for salary and overtime that were meant to go all year. This is because the service is grappling with an unprecedented number of White House protectees. Under Trump, 42 people have protection. That includes 18 members of his family. That is up from a number of 31 total during the Obama administration. Overwork and constant travel have also been driving an exodus from the Secret Service ranks. Yet without congressional intervention, there won't even be money to pay agents for the work they've already done. What to do about all this? Well, Jacksonville attorney Michael Stansky just happens to be a former special agent with the Secret Service, and he joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Thank you, Moses. Nice to be back.
So you were in the service for some time as a special agent. What were your responsibilities?
So I was an agent for a number of years down in the Miami field office, and I pretty much ran the gamut of not only protective missions for folks that visited Miami, I'd also travel out of town, but also investigative missions, which is part of the Secret Service as well.
And, of course, the Secret Service has a long and storied tradition of they're willing to take a bullet for the president or whomever they're guarding. When we learn that they're at this crisis point now, as someone who worked in the service, what were your initial thoughts when you read about this?
I think one of the things that I really liked about it is the fact that it's getting the attention it deserves. This is a classic Washington problem. There's plenty of blame to go around from the Secret Service and their poor management over the years, Congress's intervention or lack of intervention, and then also in the executive branch as well.
Okay, so let's take those one by one. You said beginning with the Secret Service and their poor management. Where has the Secret Service fallen down?
I think that they've fallen down with retention and then just anticipating the threats. We live in a new era right now, and I very much think that the Secret Service was kind of planning for 20 years ago today. There weren't things like chemical, nuclear, biological weapon threats. There weren't infrastructure threats. There weren't drone threats that we're thinking about. All the while, and that's just the protective piece, all the while the investigative mission that a lot of agents perform has also been increasing with hacking and identity theft. So all of those things put together, they just don't have enough people to do the work.
And what a difficult job it is, even if there are enough people.
Absolutely.
It's a 24/7 job, one false move, and someone's dead.
And, I mean, the line agents are the best in the world at what they do. There's hands down, the president of the United States is the most protected person in the history of the world. So they do an excellent job of what they do. However, they just need more people to do it and more money to do it.
And Congress needs to make that happen, you
Absolutely.
Think. And they're not.
They're really not. And the House took up a bill to try and increase the salary caps. The current salary cap is $160,000 a year. And they took up a bill to increase that in election years only. But they did that in the election year. So instead of thinking years ahead, they waited until 2016 to try and get the salary cap waived for 2016, which is just poor work.
Okay. What about the third piece you mentioned, the executive branch itself? The president has Trump Tower and Mar-a-Lago, both difficult and expensive residences to protect. And he's been visiting them a lot. This seems to be stretching the Secret Service capabilities to its limits.
It really is. Now, the one thing that I would say is the president has his prerogative to travel wherever and whenever he wants. And the Secret Service will have their mission, and they will protect him 24/7 wherever he decides to do that. If he wanted to sleep in a tent in Central Park, they'd be there to help him out with that. But his awareness that this is causing strain not only on the service, but also for local law enforcement that is not reimbursed when he travels to Mar-a-Lago and some other of these places. It should be noted, and his lack of awareness of that certainly could be an issue.
At the same time, the Secret Service is disclosing now that there are more than 1,000 agents who are working basically around the clock who aren't getting paid.
It's complicated overtime rules, but essentially they have hit their max and they will not make any more money than they actually are.
So they had the expectation of overtime, but they're not going to get it.
That's true. And something that should be kind of noted is that overtime is not what many people think of it to be. First off, a lot of agents are going to work more hours and not get the overtime. And the overtime is going to have to be scheduled beforehand. So it's not something like I worked 8 hours and then had to spend an extra 2 hours on the job and then I get overtime. That's not kind of how it works. Mm-hmm. This is all scheduled prior to, which kind of brings me up to my first point is the lack of management and resources that the Secret Service have. They know ahead of time. They should know ahead of time. And that's what's kind of causing a lot of these issues.
We haven't had a failure with this agency since, correct me if I'm wrong, November 22nd, 1963. Does it keep you up at night as a former agent to think that this current situation could lead to some kind of security breach that could end in tragedy?
Not really. I think that the security of the president is number one, and I think the agents are going to be doing everything that they need to provide that protection. The question becomes, if you're dedicating these resources to that piece, and that is a no-fail mission, what is going out the window? And what's going out the window is fraud investigations. It's other pieces in your community and communities around the United States that you're suffering.
This stress on the agency, though, you clearly think it's not sustainable.
It's not. And it's not with the increased threats. And unless there are some changes at the top, I know that there's a new director. He seems to have be doing some good things in there, but there are plenty of other managers below him that probably just need to go or be replaced.
Despite all of that, I can tell you're proud to have served in this way.
It's absolutely. I served with a great group of individuals. They are patriots, and like I said, this is a no-fail mission. So they're doing good things, but they just like I said, the management and the funding piece needs to follow through.
We'll continue to follow it. In the meantime, he's a contributor to the show, Jacksonville attorney and former Secret Service agent, Michael Stansky. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
In a moment, some new music from our own music director, David Luckin.
Main characters with autism seldom end up on screen. Rain Man is a notable exception. But more shows are including characters on the autism spectrum. Producers say they want accurate, honest, three-dimensional portrayals. How is TV dealing with autism today? And what's it like seeing your condition depicted? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2017 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at JaxReady.com or download the JaxReady app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by GuideWell Insurance Agency, exclusively serving members of Florida Blue.
Sit back, relax, and travel back in time with 89.9 on Sunday nights beginning at 7 with Radio Theater.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Doo-wop Revival.
Good evening, I'm Glenn Fisher, the king of the doo-woppers.
Relax Radio. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Online at WJCT.org. Looking forward to looking back.
This hour, lots of new music to be heard all across the radio schedule here on 89.9. Our own music director, David Luckin, is here to ease us off into the rest of the workday. Hey, David.
Good morning. A little chill-out music. First thing in the morning, I like that. Just thought I'd bring you up to date on some things we've done and are going to do. Hotsy Totsy, we put that on a break now. We had a great summer run of music from the 20s and 30s.
So and what a great run it was.
And it sure was. I love the music. I learned so much. We're still open to your comments on that one, so let us know what you think. Melissa, the JSO is coming back, in case you didn't know, since you co-host that.
Yeah, the symphony.
They will
brand new season on our air.
Back in October. We'll record the first show in a couple weeks. We have two new music programs coming on in October also, and we're gonna save some of that info, but you're going to be impressed with two new shows on Sunday nights. We've also got a special Route 66 on September 11th. I interviewed a Vietnam veteran yesterday to set you straight on how important music was during the Vietnam era, especially in country.
The Adrian Cronauer era?
Exactly.
That's what I think of.
And my friend
Good
Willie.
Morning, Vietnam.
Exactly. Willie Hager came in. You've interviewed him, and he told me how important the music was to bring a bit of home back to the soldiers in Vietnam.
And they would listen to music all over the country,
reel
music
to
of that
reel.
Era.
He was telling me how reel to reel was the way they recorded, sent messages home, and folks at home would record the radio with the microphone, so they would hear music that the Armed Forces radio wasn't playing, for obvious reasons, the anti-war kind of songs, and they would send messages back and forth. So technology was a big part of keeping the communication open.
Yeah, when my dad was in Vietnam, he would send home these little tapes like that, and on side,
oh, you know then, yeah.
On side one, he would talk to me and my brother, and we were 3 and 5 years old. And then he'd flip it over, and on side two, he would talk to my mom.
Oh, nice.
So my mom would play us the A side, and then she'd send us off to bed, and she'd listen to the B side by herself.
And did you send messages back?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, that's great. Well, you just verified his whole story. Not that I doubted it. But
I remember that so vividly, yeah.
That's what Willie was telling me about, how important that was and how people brought their culture with them. It was really the first war where the soldiers, the second wave, more the 68, 69, 70, where kids were bringing cassettes and music to the battlefield.
So that's going to be a special Route 66 on September 11th.
And then look forward to the Ken Burns special. I think it's the 17th, the following Sunday.
Yes, and that's going to be an amazing PBS program, the Ken Burns multi-part series on the Vietnam War. I can't wait to see that.
Boy, if it's anything like the Civil War, baseball, New York, or the Roosevelts, and I'm sure it will be, it'll be brilliant, because if you've ever seen anything Ken Burns did that you just didn't flip
you
out
learn
for?
You such an incredible amount, and I just cannot believe the old photos and even old film footage he digs up.
Yeah, or
it's
the reading of letters.
And
he's a master at making great documentaries.
Oh, yeah. Now, last but not least, tonight at 9, it's the Electro Lounge.
And we've got all kinds of music, from classic Dylan to what we started this segment with, a group called Weather Tunes, as usual, a pretty eclectic mix on the Electro Lounge. Tuesday through Saturday, if you want to just chill out and forget the crazy world that we're living in, it's a great place to be.
And every night on 89.9, it's after hours, which means you can listen to an incredible array of music you'll hear nowhere else on the radio dial, all under your umbrella, David Luckin.
Well, tonight, Ryan Bank will do Indie Endeavor, and tomorrow night, Blues Horizon. Thursday, Christian McBride's show, Jazz in America Tonight, is just brilliant. He goes all over the country. Friday nights, of course, Mr. John Maycumber. This is about his 10th year of string theory. And we would be remiss, and I would get a call if we didn't say Doo-Wop Revival, Sundays and Mondays with Glenn Fisher, because that's a great show. And he just told me his newsletter is being read all over the world. He's got like 10 countries that are tuning in and reading his newsletter.
That's
every week.
Fantastic. From right here in Jacksonville.
Because it's doo-wop. You know, you give someone something special and they will come back over and over, like you do every day.
Well, tune in to 89.9 any time of day, but make sure that you check out our after-hours block of music programming every night. It is really like nothing else in town. David Luckin, always so good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Do we have a little more music?
Sure. We'll hear a little weather tunes here. This will be in tonight's program.
Okay. You'll hear this tonight, a little weather tunes from David, and that is our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, with major floods, it's when, not if, for many cities. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We're taking a day off tomorrow, but make sure to tune in at 9 a.m. for our quarterly program, Faith Matters. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.